My name is Phil McKenna. I'm an environmental justice reporter with Inside Climate News. I've been writing this past year about Standing Rock. Traveled out to North Dakota last August and December, writing now a lot about environmental justice communities in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands following Hurricane Maria. Our panel today is Environmental Justice in the Age of Trump. And we'll start out with a moderator-led discussion for the first half, with me asking questions to all of you, and opening up in the second half to questions from all of you. There's a lot happening in D.C. at the moment affecting EJ communities, but what I really want to focus on today is what's happening at the community level itself. Looking at environmental risks through the lens of race and class. Now, how, for example, are EJ communities impacted by federal policies, by executive orders, regulatory rollbacks, and proposed budget cuts? How is the ongoing hurricane season affecting EJ communities, and are the impacts disproportionate to those communities compared to the rest of the United States? What impact is the ongoing pipeline boom and the proposed scale back of national monuments having on Native communities in the American West? And how is the petrochemical plant build out along the Gulf Coast affecting low income and minority communities that have long struggled for basic rights to clean air and clean water? Speakers on our panel today are Yesenia Funes. Yesenia is an EJ reporter with Earther. She previously covered climate justice for Color Lines and was the racial justice editor at Yes Magazine. She also runs La Calentura, a blog that looks at where the environment and its rising temperatures meet race and what it means for people of color. Also with us is Nina Sotija. Nina is an investigative reporter for the Texas Tribune and a radio producer for Reveal, a public radio program from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Nina won the Peabody Award for Hell and High Water, a 2006 investigation with ProPublica on how Houston is or was a, quote, sitting duck for the next big hurricane. Also with us is Jenny Monet. Jenny is a freelance journalist covering indigenous issues around the globe for the Center for Investigative Reporting, PBS NewsHour, PRI The World, and many other publications. Jenny was arrested earlier this year while covering Standing Rock, arrested in February, and she was recently honored as the Journalist of the Year by Newswomen's Club of New York. Jenny is a member of the Laguna Pueblo tribe in New Mexico. I would like to start with our first question. EJ communities have long been under attack. What, if anything, is different now? And anyone can jump in and go down the row however you want to do.
All right, I don't mind kicking us off. I think what might be different these days, because as you mentioned, EJ has always been an issue before Trump. Under the Obama administration, we saw a lot of environmental justice issues as well. But I think that there's this sort of anger that people are feeling toward the Trump administration that is powering resistance efforts in ways that... It could be interesting. You're seeing, you know, communities in Texas and also in Louisiana responding to pipeline battles, inspired by DAPL and creating camps, creating huge resistance efforts, almost as a personal... It seems like the DAPL thing was personal to them, so now they're responding in ways that I think is inspired out of the Dakota Access Pipeline. And I see that as a direct response to the Trump administration. And yeah, I think that it's just creating a new environment where people are willing to now take further steps and be a little bit more aggressive in ways that they might not have in previous administrations.
Yeah, if we're going down the line, you know, I want to know, coming from a state like Texas, you know, this was a battle long before Trump. I think in most states, you know, it's been a battle for a long time, and I think we've dealt with state leaders who question basic scientific concepts. And we're not just talking about climate change, but also is ozone bad for you at levels above 75 parts per billion? I mean, these are questions that are being asked still in Texas state government. So it means there's, you know, there's been an issue for a long time, well before Trump. I do think that some of what you're saying, I'm seeing as well in terms of advocacy organizations deciding that they want to go out and collect data themselves, and they want to get more savvy. And it's not just they want to go beyond. You know, members of our community are getting sick, and we think it's because of X. And they want to go out and they want to get the data, which is great because I think we need more of it. I've definitely sensed a change in terms of advocacy organizations in Texas from that standpoint. I don't know whether that's about Trump. I don't know whether that's about the Texas State Administration or a combination, or about other things. They've been able to get the funding. They've had members that are now committed to that. So I think people are definitely feeling energized, frustrated, energized. And I want to say a little bit about Harvey as well, and I think it's important to I was on it, but we just had the Texas Tribune Festival in Austin, and we – you know, I was on a panel, I was moderating a panel called All About Flooding, and, you know, we talked mostly about Houston and about Harvey, and we had this professor there, her name is Hanadi Refai, and she's at University of Houston, and she does a lot of work on this issue, and she kept kind of asking throughout the panel, what about environment? What about environment? How are communities being affected by the air pollution that was released as a result of plants shutting down from Harvey or toxic chemical releases? And so I still think we have some work to do in just covering those. There's so much else to do with Harvey that, you know, I just want to mention that that's something I still think is actually not really getting covered as much.
Thanks, Nina. Grazie, hello. My name is Jenny Monet. As Bill introduced myself, I am a citizen of the Puebla of Laguna. Thank you for letting me speak to you today. In response to the question, it's kind of funny because for tribes, they're just kind of used to having bad presidents. it gets mistaken for political apathy, but I mean, there's a long history of just bad decisions and its impact for tribes. So the Trump administration is just a repeat of that. And sure, to be sure, there is some great apprehension for tribes today with relationship to protection of their lands, but also their very tribal sovereignty. It's at risk. We saw 50 years ago the federal government exercise extreme might at chipping away at this sovereignty in an era called the Termination Era, which really attacked treaty lands. And so once you start chipping away at these treaty agreements protected by these constitutional rights, right, with treaties involved, there's a real concern among tribes, and so they're treading very carefully right now. But I would just add that these patterns of environmental injustice for tribes have been ongoing and have for decades, generations, actually. It's a story on a story. And it was happening even in the heart of DAPL before Trump was even elected. The militarization that happened on that prairie, the response to those water protectors that were largely unarmed, that was before Trump, right? I think we just need to remember that we were already living in that kind of climate, and it wasn't just on the reservation, it was happening in Ferguson too. So, I mean, we need to just, the morning remarks from the plenary today were, I was quite pleased to hear that race entered the equation and that militarization entered the equation, because those are two fundamental threats that we're looking at when we're talking about environmental justice today. When we're talking about covering them and really looking at it through a lens of how these systems of our democracy, policing, are being used in such a way as in the Dakota Access Pipeline to protect a multi-billion-dollar corporate energy project. And that really was a big part of that story. It wasn't the network of camps that were there. That was great. That was the repertoire. But we are talking about the politics of that and the militarization, the history of environmental racism, the treaty rights that were at hand. And so all of those conversations have just been ongoing prior to Trump. Standing Rock certainly what I appreciate about what Standing Rock did is it brought a lot of people who typically don't understand these concepts that are inherent to tribes, such as tribal sovereignty and these long-held agreements. It finally got people to be very aware about that. Even the U.S. Department of Army, who said, you know what, on December 4th, we should consider those treaties and call for an environmental assessment to be conducted. That's huge. That doesn't happen all the time, and we need to not forget that. And my job moving forward with all of the fanned-out activism that we're seeing from the water protectors of Standing Rock and the inspiring advocacy that's happening in lots of other tribal communities and not in non-Indigenous communities as well, people who were uplifted by the people power at play at Standing Rock, is to always remember that that was also part of the spark that was ignited, particularly when I'm talking about the Indigenous narrative.
Yeah, I'm hearing some really interesting answers. So that, you know, EJ communities are they're angry, and there's this newfound sense of urgency. Also, that, you know, this is a new. You know, 2 years ago, Texas was saying ozone is not a problem for human health. Maybe it's good. And then Jenny saying, you know, I mean, Trump is nothing new. As Indigenous communities see him, he's the latest in a long line of really bad and hurtful presidents. What I'm interested in now is how are EJ communities responding? You know, you mentioned a bit about engaging with scientists, getting more savvy. I'm wondering if you can all tell me a bit about what you're seeing, how communities are responding to increasing threats to their communities, to their environment.
That's you, Nina. Okay, sorry. So I'm going to do something that I did in the last panel too, sorry. EJ communities, I mean, I guess what I want to, I think it's good to define them maybe not so narrowly. You know, and I think one of the things that we're seeing now, even outside of environmental, talk about environment and environmental injustices, is overall injustices. So, and the history of that, and you talked about environmental racism. You know, it's racism in all sorts of forms. It's segregation. It's why were these communities allowed to evolve, or not evolve, but allowed to be the way they were? And I think along with trying to gather more data, we're also talking more, and communities are also talking more about why are things this way. It's not, again, it's not new. Why is it that, you know, people of certain races, you know, lived in neighborhoods that were zoned industrial? I mean, those are things that happened decades ago, and I think only now people are coming to terms with how institutional this is. So I guess I just wanted, I don't know if that really answers your question, Phil, but I did want to say, I think another thing that communities are trying to do is to say, you know, here's the history of why this is the way it is, and you can't fix it until you look at how embedded and how deep that and how institutional that those decisions were, and they were made by the government. They weren't just made by, you know, angry residents of a town. I've been thinking about this a lot because I'm reading this book called The Color of Law. I don't know if anyone else has read it, and it's really actually about you know, why America and communities in America are segregated racially, and how that was really a decision. It's not de facto, it's de jure. Even today, it's de jure. And governments have made decisions, and policymakers have made decisions, and it ended up touching on this sort of environmental issue as well. And why is it that so many people of color live near landfills and toxic waste sites and things like that? These are not just sort of happenstance. And I don't think that we've really come to terms with our history as a nation of how much that has been embedded and how many decisions have been made by people that we consider heroes today. So,
yeah, I always talk to, especially when talking to journalists, I always tell them, talking to journalists about reporting in Indian country, I always tell them that the backstory is just as essential as what's happening on the ground. And I think that just applies to any narrative when we're talking about environmental justice issues or justice issues in general. I mean, we have to kind of know the roots of where what we're talking about is political underrepresentation, right? And how and why that came to be. And just using Standing Rock as a symbol of that, it does involve extreme segregation. It does involve extreme imbalance in political representation. Standing Rock, residents of Standing Rock, and for that matter, all the North Dakota tribes have perhaps the worst set of voting right laws against them. So when we look at just voting right laws and how that might impact how a water supply that was supposed to cross through Bismarck originally, which is a 95% white community, but then it got redirected to Standing Rock, half a mile away from their tribal borders, where they're stopped at the polls because their tribal citizenship cards, which are good enough to pass an international border, aren't sufficient enough to cast a vote. And those are the roots that we're talking about when we look at the whole table of issues that are linked to this kind of injustice and imbalance, inequality.
I also get the sense that, like, some communities of color are getting, you know, a little fed up with having to constantly, like, retell history and educate folks, and tired of constantly having to just say this is what's happening. And I'm seeing more communities taking action upon themselves to, you know, try to effect change and create the systems that they want to see in their communities, be it, you know, community solar programs or mostly renewable energy. But you're seeing it with the Puerto Rico situation post-Maria. Everyone's been talking about, is this an opportunity now to completely rebuild the grid and convert an island that's almost entirely run on fossil fuels into the next, you know, solar project? Tesla tweeted last night about trying to get on that project and potentially be the one to make it happen on the island. So I think it's also important to recognize that communities are, I think, now using this opportunity to really create environmental justice and climate justice by advocating for themselves. And that's ultimately what environmental and climate justice is about, right? Like, giving communities the power that they need to then create the systems instead of having to rely on, you know, big green organizations, so on and so forth.
Mm. Yeah, I think Puerto Rico is going to be a fascinating test case of how they rebuild and where the funding comes from. I think it's great to see companies like Tesla stepping up, but I think we're all anxious to see how the federal government rebuilds, what they fund, what they don't fund. Are things rebuilt business as usual, or built better, more resilient going forward? We talked a lot about the history of why and the color of why, but I'm still really interested in hearing, you know, how are communities responding? What are they doing? Is there a greater sense of urgency? Is there a feeling of hopelessness? What does their fed up feeling translate into? A couple of things you said to me that I'm thinking about, features that you've written, looking at the Moapa tribe, their solar project, and also Uniondale, New York, and Long Island. Maybe you could talk a bit about those and more about how how they're teaming up with scientists, what that looks like, what are the things they're testing for.
Right, so the Moapa Band of Paiutes, I wrote about kind of the situation they've been having. They're located in Nevada, and they used to have a coal generating plant, which, you know, created and drove most of their economy. They finally got it to shut down after, you know, a multi-year struggle. And this kind of, I think, highlights the issue and the tension that you can see sometimes when talking about EJ. Because the simple answer would be to, you know, people should be creating solar projects and people should be transitioning toward renewable energy. But there are a lot of communities that rely on dirty fossil fuels as a source of income. So when that transition comes around, it can be a point of conflict. But, you know, I wrote the story after the Trump administration was making the big push for coal to try to show that, you know, economies can, in fact, thrive when solar projects enter. And they built a whole solar plant, which is not yet being used to power their communities. But, you know, it's a new source of income and potentially paving a way for them to pull from that for their own communities, which is exciting. And I think it's also just a response to the argument that coal can be revived, right? Because that's an argument being pushed heavily by the Trump administration. As to the Uniondale story, I grew up in Uniondale. It's a little town in Long Island, and it's predominantly Black and Latino, and I've seen solar panels pop up everywhere, literally, like, at every block you'll see a house or two that has solar panels on it, which was super fascinating to me. And, you know, that's not a response to the Trump administration, but I think it shows that communities of color, regardless of who's in power and the kind of policies that they're advocating for, have an interest in the renewable energy sector. And that's not a narrative that you hear when you, you know, read and talk about the renewable energy sector. It's often painted as something for the upper middle class, you know, white people. And this is a pretty low income middle class, you know, community of color. And there are solutions to getting access to this energy. And people want it. And I think that it's important that stories are being told that let folks know that this is something that people want and potentially, you know, change the landscape of what the administration is hoping to fund and create. Because I know that the state is a little concerned of how much there's like a leasing program that the state helps, that the state funds that then helps create, you know, more affordable renewable energy. And if they don't have the funding for these projects, then there's concern of will this continue? Will this grow? Is it going to get stagnant? But I also wanted to mention, you know, you talked about hopelessness, and I recently wrote a story about Latinos, you know, turning to religion in wake of all these hurricane disasters. And a source told me that potentially, given our political landscape, people could be turning more into religion in this kind of sense of hopelessness to answer answer the questions that they can't find answers for themselves. And I think that's just something to I guess, dwell on. What does this hopelessness look like? Because I don't know the answer to that myself. So I'd love to hear more of what we all think about that.
Oh, actually, you know what? I can use this one. Yeah, I don't know. I was just on a panel this morning about kind of so-called doomsday reporting, and I once again questioned the title of the panel. And, you know, how to get people to feel hopeful or whether that's part of our responsibility as journalists. You know, I haven't seen a lot of hopelessness. You know, and I think that, again, like we've been talking about, people have been energized. To be a little bit more specific, I'm not the one that has been covering this area recently. It's been more some of my colleagues at the Texas Tribune. But I think there has been a push from a lot of environmental groups in Texas to get their own kind of mobile air monitors, you know, types of equipment and things like that, that they can go around and, you know, see what's in the air right in front of them. And interact with scientists at local universities in Houston to try and use that data in an academically sound way. So I think that's really interesting and important. And I think you know, we along with ProPublica reported on, I believe it was the Environmental Defense Fund, you know, a bigger organization that provided us with some data on benzene levels after Harvey, which the EPA would not provide. So we've been able to, you know, we've been hearing more about data collection from some of these groups, and I think that's important. And I really don't that was happening at least in Texas, definitely before Trump. I think what's going to be interesting now is, of course, what's going to happen to and what has already happened to some of these EPA rules that would have really affected Texas. Again, you know, Texas has sued over almost every single one of them and managed to stall them anyway. But maybe now, you know, if we'll see whether the EPA decides to go ahead with them at all. So that's going to be interesting to watch.
I'm not seeing hopelessness either. I was just at Standing Rock, and there was a somewhat of a small reunion there of water protectors, and it was really wonderful to see what people have decided to do with their time and their lives after they left those camps in February. And many of them have gone on to other pipeline battles. Others have gone on to tribal communities where they're non-EJ struggles, but just as important. And then certain people have stayed at home to continue fighting the fight, even though oil is flowing through the DAPL. The court battle continues. And then there's the looming Keystone XL. Among the water protectors who are fighting and organizing around that, it's not a hopelessness, but it's a real awareness, because what they're seeing on the ground is already a counter movement happening among law enforcement in South Dakota, where the pipeline is expected to pass through more sacred lands on the Cheyenne River Sioux tribal treaty lands. And so it's just a repeat of a narrative that we've seen, except this time, what people are starting to realize is that the police are organizing in a pretty methodical manner, where they're getting protest training. They're starting to accrue more militarized equipment than what they already had in North Dakota. They're taking lessons learned from law enforcement, and I use that term in quotes, because whose laws, right? This rule of law, the there's treaty law and then there's these other laws. And that conversation doesn't get played out. But there's a real awareness, I think. And I think the foot soldiers on the ground who are deeply embedded in this movement are really seeing the effects of that. I know one of the, I guess you could call him a leader, who is a spokesperson for the Standing Rock anti-protest opposition, has told me that he's been followed by unmarked cars in South Dakota, has been questioned. Police know he's on a first-name basis with police that he's never met. So it's that kind of counterterrorism, intelligence surveillance that just hasn't even ended that we saw, that we now know existed at Standing Rock. I would just say, and perhaps there's a frustration too, and perhaps I'm more closely connected to this frustration than most people, is that these stories aren't getting out there. There is a severe underrepresentation of these stories and these narratives still playing out. It already existed at Standing Rock. I mean, I was very appreciative of Phil's reporting very early on, but he was the exception. After a dog attack that we saw, hadn't seen in such a manner since the civil rights era, we couldn't even get legacy media to report on that. There's something wrong with that. And that's continued. It's just perpetual. It's so routine for tribal communities because they're often seen as these foreign lands and they're treated as such. So I think that's where I personally find not a hopelessness, but a deep, deep frustration, because Standing Rock did represent that people finally got it, but it's so hard to keep that going. And it doesn't, why does it have to be?
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm wondering if you can talk a bit more about that, Jenny. The challenges that you face, both personally, being arrested as a reporter covering Standing Rock, but also challenges now as the news media, you know, a year after moving away, have forgotten about Standing Rock, and also with the challenges that all news media face, the closing shutdown recently of Indian Country Media Network. How challenging is it?
It's some days it feels like it is next to impossible. Here's the irony. I'm an independent journalist, and I feel like that is the best place and the best use of my time rather than being employed by a full-time newsroom. And I'll tell you why. Because at least as an independent, I have more gatekeepers that I can pitch to and get turned down perhaps less than the two or three gatekeepers that I'm working with in an organized news organization. And that's just based off my 20 years experience of working for some of the biggest brands in our industry. It's pathetic that my hand-to-mouth existence is better served because I can go out and reach more people pounding the pavement, working for these stories. And it's a calling. It really is a calling for me, because what the other side of that coin is that we either, one, have these stories not covered at all, which since the closing of Indian Country Today, I can count at least three stories that I know I would have seen published in that worthy stories, important stories, that otherwise have just been completely dissolved because of this blackout with this with the only publication devoted to original content from tribal community. I'll just kind of go inward for a moment, because when I did say that it was a calling, that is what led me up to Standing Rock. I reported for 6 consecutive months on the movement from September until the camps were raised in February. And September 3rd was my first day arriving, the day of those dog attacks. And I returned to the reservation 5 times till December 1st, arriving with the veterans. And that's when I decided to embed myself on the reservation and see the movement through. Because on election night, I stayed up all night trying to understand what a Trump administration was going to mean for this movement. And it did not look good. And I made a decision that night that I knew I needed to get up there. On February 1st, the day I was arrested, I was the only credentialed journalist on the scene, and that was not uncommon leading up to the December media frenzy that we saw, if any of you were a part of that or saw. And after that decision on December 4th, I was not surprised when everybody went home and never came back. So I was at my attorney's office last week, or a week or so ago, when I was back in Bismarck and in North Dakota. We were talking about my case. I faced two misdemeanor charges, one for criminal trespassing and one for engaging in a riot. Both are Class B misdemeanors, and my jury trial is set for June 2018. Then I was talking to my attorney why my charges weren't dropped, because we've been persistently requesting that they are. One, I was told, was that the state's attorney general is battling peer pressure from his legal colleagues. How can he possibly go sit with his good old boy network and feel any kind of ounce of pressure to uphold the First Amendment? That's what my attorney told me. One of the few liberal attorneys. He's the attorney that represented Amy Goodman. And then the second one, when I asked him if perhaps there was more consternation about dropping my charges because I was Native American or a journalist or a woman or I worked for an independent media source that wasn't a legacy brand because all of my clients were nonprofit, or, he said it was probably all those things. I think working independently, also, you just open yourself up for that kind of lack of protection that one gets when they have a news outlet behind them, and it gets a lot better. Those protections get a lot better when you're working for corporate media. But when you're independent, and then also when you're independent and a person of color, I didn't realize it at the time, but I've been talking to a lot of POCs who are in the same position that I am, and it's kind of striking what we face and others don't.
Well, thank you. Yesenia, and, you know, not facing the same challenges, not facing arrest, not having to pound the pavement for every story, but yet you still have gatekeepers. You have fewer gatekeepers that you can go to for stories. Is it a challenge for you to get your editors to report on, let you report on EJ's stories, give you the space that you need to tell the stories that you want to tell, or finding the publications to work for that allow you to tell those stories?
Well, at my previous position at Curlines, environmental justice was my sole topic to write about. So I was lucky enough that that's all I had to worry about on a day-to-day basis. And I worked for a media company, Curlines, that highly valued people of color. I mean, it's a racial justice news organization that centers the narratives of people of color. So literally every story we do that we did, is for, written by and for people of color for the most part. Which is a kind of, unique thing, I think, in the media landscape. So I was lucky in that resort. But environmental justice is a tricky beat to write about every day. And it's tricky because there's so many things that happen in the environmental news world. And to kind of take that EJ lens on things can be tricky. I mean, when I was writing for Curlines every day, it felt like every day there was a new, rule being taken down by the Trump administration. Some methane rule here, or some coal ash rule there. And it's hard, I think, as an EJ writer to determine which stories do I cover, which stories do I not cover, and to agree about that with your editor. I think that can be tricky sometimes, is coming to agreement on what topics deserve the attention, especially when you work for a really small nonprofit media news group that has only, so much capabilities. I mean, it's an important topic to write about. I wish there were more environmental justice reporters out there with editors who understand the topic and can give them the support that they need to successfully report on it. Because ultimately, environmental justice is a topic that requires, I think, an investigative skill set, because a lot of these stories are things that you have to unearth and show it to the world. Environmental justice is just going to come knocking on your door the way other stories might sometimes. And that requires, you know, a good support system. But I'm hopeful that at my next position that that'll be the case, but we'll see. I start Monday.
I would say I definitely feel very lucky at the Texas Tribune and Reveal to have, you know, I'm on a pretty loose leash. You know, you really need, you need time and you need space, not just to report, but also to think. Like, you need to be able to do your interviews and then think about how you're going to present them. And it's just, it's a huge amount of resources you need to be able to travel. You know, there's no way you can do these stories, you know, on the phone. You know, that's a huge, you have to show up. You have to show up, otherwise people aren't going to trust you. They're not going to trust that you're going to, and a lot of them think, hey, you're showing up once, are you going to come back? So, you know, it's time, it's money, it's resources. We've been lucky. And I think it's really more, you know, certainly bandwidth of all the different things we have to cover. I think we have to, you know, make our own choices. It's less, for me, it's less my editors as gatekeepers, and it's more like myself. Like, I have to figure out what the priorities are, and I don't think I always make the right decisions on that front. I was lucky, you know, when I first got to the Tribune about a year in, I was environment reporter for the first 2 years, and we were able to do a series I'm very proud of called Undrinkable about, you know, undrinkable water in border communities. We went to 4 different border communities on the Texas-Mexico border and wrote about why they can't drink their tap water. I worked on that with our, at the time she was our healthcare reporter, now she's our demographics reporter, Alexa Ura, and it was amazing to work with her, but it took months. It took an enormous amount of travel, you know, it took language resources that at the time I didn't have. I'm sort of learning now. You know, Alexa obviously is, she's from Laredo, she's fluent. It took so many different things, but we were able to work on that with Univision as well. A lot of the border TV stations that are, you know, well watched on the border covered our series, which was great. But that's, you know, we haven't necessarily been able to do an environmental justice story like that again with those types of resources. And I wouldn't blame my editors. It should be more on our minds. The other thing I want to say, though, is that it can sound niche when you're talking about environmental justice, but it affects everyone. It's bad for everyone. I mean, it's like, I think there's this conversation now going on about, you know, keep going back to segregation and housing. I mean, people are talking about it now as though it's bad for everyone. It's not just bad for the people who are oppressed and the people who are marginalized. It's bad for everyone. It's bad for society. So I think we have to write about this with that lens. And then it doesn't become niche anymore, and it doesn't become this impression of going to a foreign land. It's like, this is your government too. And it's not. It's going to have effects for you down the line, even if you're not there in the moment.
Thing to that, I think there's also runs a risk that without the time and commitment that gets invested in these stories, that runs the risk of looking as advocacy. And that's just, you know, there was some comment made today at the morning plenary, just, you know, we're living in this climate where press freedom, you know, the actual credibility of our jobs, our profession is just under just ridiculous attack. And you know, just my experience of being a Native American woman covering a Native American movement, I couldn't even escape the term activist if I tried. Anybody just labeled me as such because you're Native, right? I couldn't possibly be an objective journalist covering that story. So there runs these risks, and I think that the diligence that we bring right now is our A game. I overcompensate just because of the fact that I'm automatically labeled some kind of advocate.
Nina, I was wondering if you'd tell me a bit more about having written Hell and High Water and then seeing Hell and High Water play out this past month or two. What was it like having written about it, and what are you seeing now? How is Hurricane Harvey affecting EJ communities? How is it proportionate to other communities?
Sure. I'll just say, you know, Hell and High Water was a project that looked at what would happen if a Category 5 hurricane hit the Houston area dead on. So not what happened. You know, we had a Category 4 hit in a different part of the Gulf Coast. and thankfully there were not that many lives lost, although Rockport is completely devastated, and it's a real tragedy. So Hell and High Water did not come to pass. There was a day or so where we thought it's possible. We then did a follow-up investigation called Boomtown Floodtown, where we talked about the issue of rain, of just torrential rainfall in Houston, and I think that sort of is more what played out, just to clarify. But, you know, I think that the one thing that did come out in, that was related to Hell and High Water really was that refineries and chemical plants are affected by rain as well. I mean, it doesn't have to be storm surge. That these plants are going to shut down, there are going to be air emissions associated with that, and there are going to be, you know, potential real malfunctions, which we saw at that one plant. I keep forgetting how to pronounce it, Arkema, I don't know. You know, and it was interesting. We saw this as a real environmental justice issue when we reported on it for Hell and High Water. At the time, I wish we'd been able to get more into it in our project. Hanadi Refai, the professor I mentioned, she's actually been doing a lot of work around looking at the income level of the communities right around the plants, and you know, there's lots of ways to see that this is a huge story about environmental injustice, and that the people that would be affected by these malfunctions are generally people of color, people who don't have a lot of means, people who may not have much of an evacuation route or a means to evacuate. So I think that's a very important environmental justice story that's, again, relevant to everyone, that probably we could still stand to do more reporting on, and we could use some more data. I mean, one of the problems is after Harvey, we still don't have fantastic data about, like, exactly what happened and what kind of things were emitted and what kind of toxic chemicals spilled. At least that's, again, according to Professor Refai. She was on my panel a couple weeks ago, and she was saying that one of the things we need to improve on is, you know, communication between agencies and understanding what spilled. You know, what are the impacts of that? She's actually working on putting together a website right now where people can go and get some of this information all in one place. But she is having trouble getting it herself. So that's a big problem that we're seeing. I'll just quickly mention as well that, you know, it's interesting. We felt uncomfortable a little bit in Houston. We were going to a lot of really wealthy neighborhoods that flooded. And I think a lot of you may have seen pictures of, you know, these McMansions, things like that underwater. So important, I mean, obviously important to report on. When you look at the, you know, we published, or with ProPublica got their hands on this map of severe repetitive loss properties. And it's interesting, the top zip codes, one of them is Meyerland, which is a fairly well-off community, I would say. But the others are all are much lower-income communities, and they get a lot less coverage. So I also think that in terms of who floods and who's the most likely to flood, there's an environmental justice story there. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of talk of lawsuits. Lawsuits have been filed against the Army Corps of Engineers over flooding. And I think those lawsuits are very interesting. I think the residents there are understandably upset. I'll just say we've gone to some of these meetings. You're not seeing people of color at these lawsuit meetings. You know, you're seeing people with means, generally older, who've lived in the community for a while. Those are the people that have the means to try to, you know, take action against government and file lawsuits. And so we are working on covering stories of, you know, what about the people that don't have those means? The people that live in public housing complexes that are in the 100-year floodplain. You know, there's another story to be told, and I think it needs to be more out there after Harvey.
Very good. One last question before we open it up to questions from the audience. I was speaking with one environmental justice advocate recently in Louisiana, and she was telling me that in the past, the EPA was sort of like the last resort option that they could go to, whether or not they were successful going to EPA for help. Was another matter entirely, but she felt that they've now lost this one kind of place of last resort. Are you seeing that as well, or do you feel federal government, are your communities saying federal government was never any help? How have things changed under this administration? And I guess also, if not going to the federal government, where are these communities going? How are they advocating for themselves?
I don't think the EPA has ever been a source of, you know, I don't think it's ever been a place where communities have gone to find protection or safety when it comes to environmental injustice. I don't know where they're going now, but I get the sense that they're looking to themselves for the answers. You know, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of these people in these communities know what they want. They know how, you know, they know exactly what they need to get there. It's just a matter of funds most of the time. And I think that's going to be the biggest challenge in the face of the Trump administration, given all these huge budget cuts that are happening among the EPA, you know, and other environmental departments. Is where is the money going to come for whatever projects communities want to have going on? But I don't think that the EPA has ever been a source of, like, solace for these communities at all. I mean, there have been reports that show that the EPA has failed to acknowledge, you know, civil rights complaints in the past. So this is nothing new. I think it's just now the money, I think, is more what's concerning for communities, because it can't apply to these grants that they might have applied to before that could help fund community projects. Now they have to figure out where they're going to get that money for next.
I agree. I've not heard much from communities in Texas about going to the EPA or the Texas counterpart, which is the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. But one thing that was happening, you know, has been happening for years is that organizations have been suing companies directly, which is possible. They've been suing companies. You know, Exxon has been sued. Luminant, I believe, which owns two of the biggest coal plants in Texas, has been sued over air emissions. And the Exxon lawsuit actually resulted in a pretty large settlement. And Exxon agreed, I believe, that it's a refinery in Houston to make some improvements, pretty expensive improvements to reduce air emissions. So that's one interesting thing that I think I've seen organizations try to do. Sierra Club is one. You know, Environment Texas is another group. I think it was Environment Texas maybe that sued Exxon. So they're bypassing government. They've decided that that's their strategy, as opposed to expecting the TCEQ to the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality to take action. And, you know, we've talked to officials at the TCEQ, and they tend to take, I think, it's always they're saying, yeah, we're about enforcement, but we don't want to bring down the hammer. You know, that's their position. So groups have decided to kind of try it out themselves.
Well, because of the very nature of the tribe's sovereign-to-sovereign relationship with the federal government, they have to kind of respond to the EPA, and the EPA has always not been kind to Indian country. Most recently is the Gold King mine environmental disaster that contaminated the Animas River in 2015 in Colorado. It was this abandoned mine, and it spilled just all kinds of toxic waste into the gorgeous Animas, and it was an EPA oversight. But more historically, you know, the EPA has been somewhat neglectful to other kind of trans corporation development projects and the aftermath of that. And I'm thinking mostly about the uranium mining legacy on the Navajo Nation, which a lot of abandoned tailings and shafts were left that just over decades continue to contaminate life on the reservation. And the EPA refused Superfund status to the tribe to clean that up. And it wasn't until it was just too great to ignore that they decided to step in. And that's after, you know, their sheep herds were tainted by toxic water supplies, and people's cancer rates, where there were none, suddenly just skyrocketed. The EPA is not an agency that tribes turn to, but have to because of their sovereignty. In the case of Standing Rock, it was an interesting dynamic, though, because EPA was the one who stepped in when the tribe said, hey, we've been consulting with these people, and the Corps is saying they're not. The Corps is lying, right? Like, that was what the tribe had been saying all along. And it was the EPA and a couple of other agencies that Phil wrote about and produced these collection of letters from all of these federal agencies saying, something doesn't look right here. You know, this consultation process is not just a box you check off. There's actual steps that take place. And they're couched in these treaty rights, right? Go all the way back. But, you know, something doesn't look right. And it was actually the EPA that stepped in to to kind of support the tribe and their claims that these consultations hadn't been happening in a meaningful way. And all along you had what was happening was from the Corps in the court saying, no, the tribe is just so neglectful. They're just not picking up the phone. It was just horrible. So in one case, I can say something positive about the EPA.
All right. And on that note, we'll open it up to questions, and we'll give priority preference to SEJ members or journalists, those with blue name tags. I'll have you introduce yourself, who you are, and your question, and then I'll repeat it or give you a microphone so we get it on the recording. Yes.
I'm Karen Schaefer.
If I can reach you, I will, and if I can't, obviously.
I'm Karen Schaefer. I'm a freelance public radio journalist based in northern Ohio, and I report a lot on Lake Erie and sometimes on the Ohio River, and I now live in Trump country. I don't live in a big city, although I've reported on environmental justice problems in cities like Toledo, where the water wasn't drinkable for a while, and Detroit, where the air quality is awful. What I want to do now, though, is begin to report on those very people who voted for Donald Trump, who don't consider themselves victims of environmental injustice, but who I believe are. These are the folks who no longer can mine in coal country, but are seeing pipelines go through their backyards. These are the farmers who aren't going to be able to afford the fancy equipment to avoid the algae blooms in Lake Erie. And I'd love some advice on, you know, approaching this rural-urban divide with the knowledge that the people I'm going to be talking to are not going to be happy about talking to me.
Yeah.
Any advice?
Go ahead.
You know, I guess I wouldn't totally count on them not being happy about talking to you. I mean, I think that actually, the voters of all from all. You know, voters who voted for whoever are interested in learning information, and interested in, many of them. Some of them aren't. Some of them are. I think, you know, I would say just give them a chance, too. You know, don't assume. And I think that a lot of times, you know, I've spoken to Trump voters who were kind of, it was a single issue. They voted for him on one thing. It might have been immigration. It might have been, he promised to bring back jobs to their community. You know, you can talk to them about the other issues, which they may not have considered. So I would say that it doesn't. I think that I wouldn't paint them with one brush necessarily and decide they all don't want to hear this. I think if you have real facts and if you have real perspective to show them that is fact based, I think we should assume that we should try to communicate that to them and see how they respond. I don't know if that helps.
I have somewhat of an anecdote from Standing Rock. One of my most valuable sources was a white bigoted rancher that I met on my very first day of reporting. And I spent 4 hours with him, and 90 minutes, if not longer, were of him being very verbally abusive to me, calling me names, making racial slurs. I didn't get out of my car in talking to him because he had a vicious dog by his side. But I wanted to talk to him because he lived right on the easements, and I needed a way in. When I got to Standing Rock for the first time, I didn't go to the camps. I went to get a rental car, and I needed to talk to the people that I didn't know enough about. That these were the oil lobbyists, these were the people who were regulating the pipeline, and the ranchers. Because we didn't see anything about that, right? We saw everything about the novelty of these camps, but what we didn't know was this kind of other pro-oil side of the state. And so I end up talking with this guy. He ends up leashing up his dog. And the other 2 hours that I ended up speaking with him were over coffee inside his house, over his kitchen table, where he gave me this agriculture book. It's like a trade book, but also has all the maps and the holdings and the land lot demarcations and names of who owns those demarcations and addresses and phone numbers of who's on these lands and properties. And he draws this big red line of where the pipeline's going. And he's like, you want to talk to people? Here you go. It was remarkable. And that was after a four-hour conversation with him. I never talked to him. I said, after I started covering the movement, he started seeing that my stories were very indigenously centered and focused. And he said, maybe it's good that we just don't, he was very upfront, maybe it's good that we just don't talk for while you're here and reporting. And I said, I totally understand. I just was in North Dakota, and we had coffee in Bismarck, and we had a reunion of our own. And he expressed to me things that he didn't agree with about my reporting but he says, but you're one of them, so I understand. Right? But you're one of them. I get it. But then what he also did, which is what I've always valued from this source, was that he shines a light on what's not getting through. Do you see? And so we don't always have to agree. And we don't always have to see eye to eye. What is so inherent of that relationship for me was just listening. Right? And I guess it's somewhat of a tolerance for however he is, but I needed to understand that. And I don't think I would have done that if I hadn't spent those 4 hours enduring a little bit of abuse and then also just kind of having the greatest source I could have out of that story.
So don't rule them out. All right. Next question.
Yes. I will try to get you a mic, and if not, okay. Yeah, that'll be easiest.
Hi, my name is Talia Buford. I'm a reporter at ProPublica. You guys talked a little bit about this and kind of, you know, how you go about finding your stories and things like that. I'm wondering, because when I first started doing EJ, you realized that everything is EJ or can be EJ. And I'm wondering, one, how you are kind of able to, or how you decide, you know, what you're going to focus on versus what you're not going to focus on, because, you know, especially if you start reporting on these issues, people start coming to you with all of the things, and you're like, well, okay, maybe I can cover this, but I'm not sure I'm interested in that, or I don't know if this is what I'm, you know, focused on right now. And so how do you guys kind of handle that, and how do you assess that, and how do you also make sure that that your editors are interested in, especially for you, Jenny, since you are pitching to different outlets, how do you kind of make sure that you can find a story that's important to the community that you're covering, but also is something that they will actually publish?
I'll just be very brief about that. That never gets easy, ever, even with the relationships that I formed. And I have many relationships with lots of different publications. It's a slog every time. Every time. Because unlike other POC communities, somehow Indian country is just seen as this kind of like too complicated issue area to unpack, or too insider, or too something, right? Not broad enough. And so it never gets easy. And you're right, I agree with you. EJ issues relate to everything.
Yeah, that's a... I don't think this is the best answer, but I think that for us, we think a lot about what data is available. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish it makes sense that that's a bar. It's a shame because a lot of times data isn't being collected, and that's an important story as well. But I think we need to find a relationship to data. And a part of me hates to say that because there's a lot of, I mean, you know, when people say we think we're getting sick because of X, I hate to like dismiss that. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it's important to have data. And it would be nice if we could think more about, okay, well, if we don't have data, is there a way we can collect it? Can we be involved in that process, you know, in a way that is academically sound? And, you know, I think there's some interesting experiments going on in journalism right now with that. But it requires money, it requires time, and it requires expertise that most people in the newsroom don't have. But, yeah, availability of data is huge for, you know, and that's why I think we're still hoping to do more off of Hell and High Water and, you know, a big story we did in that series on storage tanks and vulnerabilities along the Houston Ship Channel, because we know that, you know, there are going to be communities that are going to be adversely affected that are not the same as other communities, and where there's a disproportionate number of people of color, a disproportionate number of people that don't speak Spanish. Don't speak English. And, you know, may not be able to understand what the warnings mean or how to get out. So, yeah, data is for right now has been our bar. Is there a better way to go? Probably, you know, there might be, but that's kind of been how it's been for us.
I feel like this question is even more relevant in the Trump age because the news is so saturated with all Trump news all the time. And I think it's hard to figure out, like, how much of your time do you want to devote to covering Trump and his, you know, his actions and his administration's actions. For me personally, I mean, because, you know, we're journalists and we write, but we also read and we also are consumers of news. So I always try to write about stories that I myself want to read. And for me, they tend to be solutions-based stories that, you know, are showing communities, that are uplifting communities. Because there's enough stories, especially in the EJ world, that, you know, kind of give you this narrative of this rundown community that, you know, is experiencing X, Y, and Z from pollution. And I think I find joy when I write stories that show a community that's resilient and combating that, be it, you know, my hometown putting solar panels on their homes or, you know, this tribe in Nevada that is converting to solar instead of coal. And I think it's important to keep that in mind because especially now in the Trump age, it's so easy to just do only Trump news and forget that there is a lot of news that has, you know, little to do with him that is just as equally important.
Mm-hmm. All right, next question.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Kevin Ritter. I'm with Appalachian Voice in Boone, North Carolina. And we just covered like pretty much the entire Appalachian region in general. And obviously a lot of Appalachia is Trump country. And whenever you mention like environmental justice or environmental racism or white privilege, like no one, it's just like the door just slams shut in any like conversation. So how do you just like get those ideas and issues across to people who just do not want to hear it at all?
4 hours.
you got 4 hours.
A lot of time, yeah. I mean, you have to be willing to go back. This is not, I don't know how well this answers your question, but, you know, in Texas, there's been hostility to the media, you know, long before Trump, I think in many states, but we have news outlets that have, I think, that sprouted up in Texas before they were as prominent nationally now after Trump has been elected. Breitbart, Texas. And we get a lot of interesting email, and most of that email goes to our operations manager, whose name is John Jordan, and I don't know what we would do without him. He's like a wonderful person and staff member, and he answers a lot of them. He answers a lot of the really hostile emails, and I don't want to assume that they're coming from someone who voted for a particular person, but if you're just talking about how to respond to hostility or how to respond to people that just don't want to hear what you're saying, I mean, you know, we get a lot of really hateful email, and John responds to a lot of it and tries to be reasonable in his response. And he has told me that he has been amazed with with their next response. Like, it is so not what the first email was. It's so like they can't even believe that somebody is on the other line listening and responded, and that changes their entire. Now, it doesn't excuse the first email. You know, but I really think that, you know, as journalists, we have a responsibility to have to deal with some of this stuff, kind of like what Jenny was saying. And when you engage with people who may not seem to want to engage with you, and you try a little bit harder than just that one phone call or one knock on the door, you know, I think it means a lot to people. Because they think that you knock on their door, you have one quick conversation, and they've made their decision about you, and a lot of us do that. And you try again, and then that's when things can change.
I would also just say it sounds like you work somewhat in a local sense there in your communities, and it's just I think it's just forming these relationships before you have to go and knock on that door, right? And that's just for any community, is to be there, be present, sit in the meetings, even if you're off the clock, so to speak, right? I mean, making those contacts that you think, here's a leader in a community that might not be the direct person that I'm going to quote, but could be my gateway to other people, whatever. And to be just that's just having that perception when you're in and among these conversations that are involving your community. Whether it's a city council meeting or a health media, I don't know, you know, whatever the local news is of the times, and just, and in North Dakota, I would go sit in the ranching community meetings, and those were very interesting, and they weren't talking about the pipeline so much, but I got to understand a lot more of what was going on in the background.
I also think that you can be mindful, I guess, of the terminology that you use, because, you know, we're using environmental justice here, but we're among environmental journalists, so, you know, most of us, hopefully all of us, know what that is already. But when speaking to communities, it might be best to put it in layman's terms, you know, like the disproportionate risk of cancer or respiratory illness due to, you know, pollutants that are based near you. You don't have to use those terms, you know, especially if a community isn't willing to digest those terms. And even in our writing, and I struggle with this, is trying to avoid the term environmental justice in my writing. But even avoiding that, I think, opens the door to more readers and more people who otherwise would have, you know, turned a blind eye to the topic.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just add again, it's important for everyone. And that's not always, like, it's easy to say that, you know, and just, like, say it. I mean, you have to prove it and you have to expand more. But and there may be other ways to tell the story. I mean, you may have data that exposes something that people don't want to hear. But I was talking about this in the other panel. If there are people that want to sweep that data under the rug, then people start to be like, oh, you know, oh, what are they keep? You know, there's other ways to, I think, get people interested in an issue, even if they can't see how it directly affects them at that moment. So that may be, you may find creative ways of doing that too.
Next question. Yes. And if you don't mind coming up and talking into the mic, that'd be great.
I want to thank you guys for doing this first. Sorry, Phil. So I'm Kat Bagley. I'm an editor for Yale Environment 360. I'm wondering, for those of us that work more for a national publication, writers or editors, who aren't based in these you know, communities or in these cities, how do we, just some practical tips of how we find these stories, how we monitor them? Because as you say, there are so many of them. And then, you know, once you get them, how you get people to trust you if you're an outsider, if you've never seen them, or, you know, if you're coming from another state or something. So, yeah.
I can talk just from, like, an indigenous perspective. Indigenous peoples are pretty vocal online. And in large part, it's because their stories are so untold. So they have a lot to say, and then they spout it off on Facebook mostly. I mean, the story of Standing Rock grew from Facebook because there was so much ignoring of what was happening there. It's there if you're looking, and it's not that hard to find. I mean, the internet's an awesome place for that. And I just think that that might be true for a lot of subcultures. I mean, I know this is somewhat unrelated to EJ, but, you know, we learned a lot from white nationalists by just doing a little digging online and understanding where these conversations are taking place. So I just think, you know, investing in maybe some of that organization and building a really comprehensive Hootsuite with lots of different threads or something, right? That would be one angle.
So most of my reporting, actually, I do over the phone. I'm one of those journalists that don't get the opportunity to fly into a lot of stories. I've only been on site for, like, one story that I've written during my time at Color Lines. And so I built the trust with my sources via, you know, telephone and email communication. So it's definitely doable. But it's tough, especially depending on the media outlet that you're with. I mean, certain media outlets sort of, you know, grant trust just in and of themselves. Like, working for Color Lines just gave communities a green light that I was someone they could confide in because of the media outlet that I was writing for. I'm assuming that would be different if, you know, someone was from, say, a legacy media outlet. But ultimately, I mean, it's just about reaching out to some of the community organizations, the grassroots community organizations. They know everything. I mean, they run around that community all day long, and they know everyone, and they are so entrenched in their work, and they're glad to connect you with people. And having just people connect you with other people helps you as well, because they know that if someone's sending you their way, that's at least some points in trust that you've already built. But, I mean, I'm a big advocate of, like, being vulnerable with your sources. I mean, they need to remember that you're also a person and a human before you're a journalist. And if they get that sense from you, then they're more willing to share and be vulnerable with you. It's easier to do that face-to-face. But you know, check in with them, give them calls. How's it going? You know, I think just the basic mannerisms go a long way when you're trying to build relationships with EJ communities when you can't get to them in person.
I also think, and this is true even if you can get to them in person, is just to be honest and transparent with them. I mean, you know, maybe you're going to spend a lot of time with someone and they're not going to end up in your story, right? Happens all the time. Maybe you're reaching out to someone during a breaking news type of event and they really want to talk to you and you got to make sure that you follow through and talk to that person. You know, I mean, those are things that are important too, especially when you're kind of, when it may seem like you're swooping in, you know, to let, you know, to be honest, to be like, hey, I'm just trying to figure out what's going on. You know, don't, you know, don't make promises. I mean, we all know that about what's going to end up in the story or whether they're going to be quoted. But, you know, when you just lay out the situation like, hey, I'm just trying to figure out what's going on. I don't know whether I'm going to do a story yet. Just be honest with them up front. I really think that they appreciate that. And they're willing to talk. And I think social media, like Jenny said, is a great. I mean, we were frankly doing that. You know, I mean, I was in Houston during Harvey, but I wasn't really able to go anywhere for the first couple of days. I mean, we chose a hotel that was in a 1,000-year floodplain so that we wouldn't get stuck, but we weren't able to go anywhere. So it was really our colleagues in Austin that were interacting with people who were stuck on their roofs. I mean, no matter, even though we were right there, we couldn't get to them either. And I think when you're engaging with people like that, just be transparent about what you're trying to do. Be friendly. Be vulnerable. And I mean, be a person. You know, it's sometimes it's hard to remember that. You know, just you don't have to act like you're not coming from this weird place. Just be clear about what you're doing. And you know, they'll respond to that, I think, really well.
Next, I think last question.
There's one over there. I think she had her hand up.
Yeah. Oh. Let's try to get, who else? I know you've had your hand up a lot. Oh, Cassie, yes.
Thinking
about her too. Yeah.
Hi, so I'm Catherine Krivacor. I'm actually just a student at the University of Pittsburgh, clearly. So my question is, well, I think we can all agree that like climate change is happening currently and it can only get worse. And things like hurricanes aren't necessarily predictable like right when they're going to happen, but rising sea levels are within the next 50 to 100 years. So how do you think environmental justice communities can get ready for that, especially in terms of displacement, because when sea levels do rise, it's not going to be the people of means that have trouble getting to other places. It's going to be people in EJ communities. So I was wondering if you could speak on that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Catherine. And are you studying journalism?
Environmental studies.
Environmental studies. Great. Well, I hope you also become a journalist and write about it. I was covering this at the time they were called America's First Climate Change Refugees in Kivalina, Alaska. It's this tiny little sliver of an island that Obama flew over in 2015 for his Alaska climate tour. And I started covering that in 2007 and actually met the LA Times reporter who came up and basically put Kivalina on the map, and it turned into this media frenzy. And at the time, his headline was something to the effect of, you know, island set to disappear in 10 years. And it goes back to what you're saying about this extreme lack of data that we have to tell these stories, because what ended up happening in this media frenzy that descended on this basically unknown location in the North Arctic was that that story got regurgitated over and over and over again. The narrative never changed. People swooped in, told the story before they had the story basically written before they even landed on this hard, remote by even Alaska standards island, right? I frame it in that way because we need to do better at these frontline stories. These are the first people that are going to be impacted, as you stated. They represent largely underrepresented community, but it's the backstory that never gets told. And for this island in Kivalina, their backstory is they have been given the shaft so many different ways by the United States that they fought this lawsuit
and trying to get the U.S. government to force their relocation. And it just got lost in a lot of the kind of intricate details that is required of these communities to unpack. And what ended up not happening was lazy journalism, really. It was too much work to go and do all the homework and the research and dig in the past to then articulately explain that in a framework that might just be too hard for our readers to understand or too much work for our readers to understand. And that's the kind of exasperation I feel like I receive when I'm talking to editors who are like, well, I just know our general audience and I just know it's not going to resonate with them because it's just too much work. It's too much work of the reader to, it's requiring too much of the reader to pay attention. So I think that we have to just do better in figuring out how to make the argument, number one, to tell those stories and make sure that they matter, but two, keep working at ways to humanize those narratives as well. And I think that those two, where they shall meet, you start to get some real rich reporting beyond just the low-hanging fruit of these stories, because it's coming.
I think that's a very important point. The kind of island set to disappear in 10 years. It's like, what story is that telling? Mm-hmm. That's like the buzzy headline where you're like, see, we told you so, climate change. I mean,
been over 10 years and the island's there.
So that didn't happen. But also, yeah, I mean, you know, the story is what's happening in that, or part of the story is what's happening in that community. Who swept whatever the real facts are under the rug? I mean, I always liked that story. So it's more than just the hey, we told you so. I think I just get the sense that we are doing a lot of these like, haha, we're right, and we're supposed to be telling stories, and we're not just supposed to be sort of patting ourselves on the back. I'm really glad that you asked this question because actually I'll put a plug for a reveal episode that's coming up. We have some folks in New Orleans who are working on a story about relocation on the Louisiana coast. We actually had a long discussion when they were doing their pitch of how do we make this also an accountability story. Mm-hmm. You know, Reveal does investigative journalism on the radio. And it was very clear. It was like, there are people that knew that this was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And they didn't tell anyone, you know. And they waited. And they waited, a really long time. So that's an important, is what is the data, and who has the data, who needs to get the data? Those are all stories that, you know, we should be doing right now. Who's disproportionately affected will be a huge part of that. But it's like, people know that this is going to happen. So, you know, why aren't they getting that out there right now? And are these communities even aware? And if they are aware, are they getting the resources they need? So I think that all involves, you know, you probably at least, if not being able to go there in person, spending a lot of time with people there and not just doing that big kind of swoop in story that you basically write before you get to the community. I think that's a great kind of storyline and a really important one.
And just piggybacking Nina, but I mean, you asked the question of what can they do? And ultimately, they can't do anything alone. And the biggest story, like you said, is the lack of action being made on behalf of the representatives, the city, federal levels, to make sure that there is a plan for when it's too late for these communities, because that's already happening. We're already seeing that happening. People always talk about climate change as something distant and something that's to come. But for communities of color throughout the globe, it's here right now. And they can't do it alone. And I think that's the story, that they need more and they're not getting any of it.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm sorry, we are over time. We're going to end it there, but our speakers will be here. Find us if you have additional questions. And thank you all speakers and audience for coming.